Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We are lucky enough to welcome back Stuart Stevens to the podcast, whose book kind of rattled a lot of us when it first came out. It was All a Lie, How the Republican Party Became Donald Trump, and it came out in paperback yesterday. So, Stuart, welcome back on the podcast.
Charlie, great to be here, man. Thanks for asking me.
So, this came out, what, 2 years ago, a year ago?
The hardcover edition? It came out a year ago in August.
Yeah, okay, so now the paperback is out. Did you update it, or has your thinking changed in any way?
Well, I wrote a preface.
This is a leading question.
I wrote a preface to the new edition that basically opens. I keep getting it wrong. In that, you know, I wrote a pretty big book about the Republican Party. I think we would agree. But it turns out, I think I was wildly overly optimistic. I never, if you'd asked me on November 2nd, 2020, if Trump loses by north of 300 and, you know, 9-10 million votes, will Republicans accept it? I would have said, yeah, of course, they won't like it, but they'll accept it. If you'd asked me, you know, breakfast January 6th, were we going to have invasion of the Capitol, I would have said, like, no, it's crazy. And if you'd asked me on January 10th, are we going to have a coordinated effort across the United States of America to change voting laws to make it harder, for the most part, for those who are less inclined to be Republicans to vote, I would have said, I don't think so. And all those things happened.
See, this is exactly why I was asking the question, because I was looking back at something that I had written and it was kind of dark. I would not say that it was optimistic, and yet I got it wrong because it's turned out to be so much worse. And for all the reasons you said, you know, that the day after the election, I thought, okay, well, that's done. The morning, I remember how you felt on January 7th or January 8th. When the people were leaving the administration and it looked like Donald Trump had been completely repudiated, and there was a sense of vindication that there was, you know, that this was the moment when maybe they were going to wake up from all of the insanity, and damn, that did not happen, did it?
Yeah, I mean, the Republican Party had a perfect chance to cleanse themselves or begin a process of cleansing themselves from Trump if they had voted to convict Trump in the second impeachment. And he couldn't have run for office. And they didn't. And to me, that moment is going to go down like the modern Munich Accord. Though the Munich Accord for Chamberlain, at least, was well-intentioned by a good and decent man who wanted to prevent war. I mean, when you go back to McConnell's statement after he voted not to acquit and then gives the case why he should have voted to acquit, I mean, to convict, it's extraordinary. And if you ask, you know, Mitch McConnell has said that he would vote for Donald Trump in 2024. And we're in a moment unlike any we've had since at least 1860, where a major party in the United States of America doesn't believe we live in a democracy. Because if you don't think that Donald Trump was legally defeated, that Joe Biden was legally elected, then we live in an occupied country and we don't live in a democracy. Right. And, you know, this whole, well, I accept that Biden is president. Well, I mean, I accept Putin as president. What does that have to do with a democracy? Nothing.
It is extraordinary. Is there any doubt in your mind that Donald Trump is running again for president?
Oh, God, no. I mean, Donald Trump is the de facto Republican nominee for president.
Is there any way that he runs and does not win the Republican nomination?
Can't imagine it.
No, I can't either. So let's stick with where you were just a few minutes ago, though. The Republican Party had the perfect opportunity to take an off-ramp, several off-ramps, over and over again, after he was defeated in November, after January 6th, with the impeachment. It was easy because he had no power, he had no clout. Traditionally, presidents, one-term presidents were defeated for re-election, do not have a tremendous amount of sway. And so the Republicans who had been privately saying, okay, well, we're disgusted about this, you know, but it's a binary choice or we need to work with them to get legislation through, they were liberated, right? They didn't have any tax bills to pass that he would sign because he was going to be leaving office. There were no more judges. They could have moved on and they didn't. So this is the puzzle, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I think probably the obvious is the answer, and that is they didn't want to. They like where Donald Trump has taken the party. And all the protestations to the contrary are false. And I think it is very difficult to argue with the statement that the Republican Party, for the most part, is very comfortable becoming an autocratic movement in the United States of America. And it's a mind-boggling concept for those of us who worked in the party to grasp, a lot of us. But I don't know any other logical conclusion to come to. And it only gets worse. You look at what's happening in Texas. This is a bounty. This is like the power of the state. We've gone from being a small government party to being the Stasi party that we're going to pay people to inform on their neighbors. Which is a quintessential definition of big government. This is what they want. I mean, at a certain point, you know, if somebody like wakes up every day and eats pancakes, you got to decide they like pancakes.
So even Mitch McConnell, who gave that speech, because clearly Mitch McConnell was at some point done with Donald Trump. If you go back and you listen to the speech he gave after January 6th, it was awfully strong. Did he just figure that Donald Trump would go away on his own? I mean, this sort of reminds me, it feels a little bit like 2015, where everybody's going, this guy's terrible, but I'm not going to put my head up. Something will come up. Somebody else will take him out, but I'm not going to do it. And this is where they're at.
Yeah, I think Mitch McConnell is a perfect example of the acquisition of power for power's sake to no purpose. Mm-hmm. And he cares about power. And that's why I go back to, I don't really look at the Republican Party as a political party in the sense that it is advocating for a philosophy of government that is coherent and can be articulated versus another theory of government. It's like a cartel. It exists to defeat Democrats. Now, that's a purpose, but it's just not a purpose that really has any sort of classic political definition. It's like OPEC. OPEC exists to sell oil. You don't ask, like, what is the moral imperative of OPEC? It's like, what does narco cartels do? They sell dope. And what does the Republican Party do? They exist to try to maintain power. And I can't see that it stands for anything beyond that.
So for the last 4 years, you've probably been asked like 100 times, maybe 1,000 times, okay, when will the Republican Party stand up against Donald Trump, right? And at a certain point, it became obvious it's never going to happen. Now, because history always echoes itself, the question is, well, when is the Republican Party going to stand up against the Marjorie Taylor Greens or the Paul Gosars or the Madison Cawthorns or the J.D. Vances or the Josh Mandels? And yet, you know what the answer is going to be. They will never do that. But it does raise the question, if the whole point of the cartel is to beat Democrats, are they doing this by embracing the crazy and by having people like Herschel Walker running for Senate in Georgia or Mandel running for Senate in Ohio or having the public face of the party be these crazies? Doesn't that undermine the general election strategy that you're describing as being, you know, what it's all about?
Well, we'll see. I mean, I've watched Josh Mandel for years. He could very well be United States Senator. Herschel Walker could win. I don't think that we should assume that the crazies are unelectable. I think the only way that you can confront the Republican Party today is to defeat these people.
Yes.
So you need more days like January 5th. You know, Mitch McConnell wakes up on January 5th, he's majority leader. He wakes up on January 6th, he's minority leader, and he's running for his life. And yet still he supports Donald Trump. You just have to beat them. You can't negotiate with this. You can't compromise with it. You can't reason with it. You have to just beat it. And I think that 2022 is obviously going to be an incredibly tough challenge for Democrats. It's only once in the last, three times in the last 125 years that the party out of power has gained seats in the off-year election. The last one was 2002. I was heavily involved in that. And we nationalized the race. And we did that successfully. And I think the path for Democrats is to nationalize this race around democracy. You have to make this a referendum on patriotism itself. What does it mean to be American? Because if you get sucked into these culture wars, if you get sucked into these little fights, you got to make it a big fight. 2002, it wasn't about foreign policy. It was about domestic security. And we were able to do that. It was hard. There were days when we lost, but we stuck to that plan and it worked. And that's what the Democrats need to do. They have to nationalize this race. Can they do it?
Let's go back to this. I think actually all politics is national at this mm-hmm. point, in part because local media has totally imploded. But we talk about so let's go back to Ohio and Georgia. If you have a conspiracy-laden bigot like Josh Mandel and a complete nut job like Herschel Walker, if they win in Georgia and if they win a general election in Georgia and Ohio, doesn't that suggest that the greatest threat to American democracy is us, is the American people, not just one political party? Because if Americans are willing to vote for people like that, as they've shown a willingness to vote for Donald Trump and may vote for Donald Trump again, you know, is our democracy being taken from us, or are we giving it away?
We're giving it away. And this is what happens. I mean, if you read books like How Democracies Die by those two Harvard professors, or The Twilight of Democracy by Ann Applebaum, which, you know, I go around giving these books out like watchtowers to random strangers in airports. Modern democracies fail not when tanks, you know, circle the TV stations usually. They fail through the ballot box and the courtroom. And that's the pattern here. And you don't see the autocratic movement in America that is serious is not about forming militias. It's not about trying to acquire weapons from Canada that we can use to overtake, you know, Washington. It's about changing laws. It's about making it harder for people who won't vote for us to vote. And that's how it happens. So, you know, I worked for the last couple of senators from Ohio and Georgia. I worked for Rob Portman and I worked for Johnny Isaacson. And could either one of them win a primary today in the Republican Party? Man, I don't think so.
No, I don't think they could. So part of this, the reason I started off by asking you the question of whether things have gotten worse and why the party didn't take the off-ramp, I think you need to double back to your main thesis, because, and this is something that I've wrestled with and you and I wrestled with last time you were on the podcast, which is the question, you know, how deeply embedded were these things within the Republican
right.
Party? I mean, there was a long time when I thought that Donald Trump was the black swan event, and obviously I've abandoned that because clearly the dysfunction was a pre-existing condition. Now, you argue that it was not only a pre-existing condition, but really baked into the DNA of the party. So, you know, I look at these things and go, I look at the people who are going along with this, and I say, apparently I didn't know you, or you've changed in some way. And some people have, right? I mean, the party that nominated Mitt Romney was not this crazy, but it had the crazy elements. There was at least the recessive gene. So how do you sort of, you know, break that out? What has changed, and what was latent, and what was always there that we didn't get?
I think a couple of things. One, I think it is a historical lesson in what we used to study when we studied civics, that leaders matter. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I go back to looking at America in the 30s when there was a huge fascist movement in America. So why didn't America become fascist? Probably because Lindbergh wasn't president or Henry Ford, and FDR was. We would have been the same country. We could have been led in a different direction. If Mitt Romney had won the presidency, he would have led the party in a different direction. It would have been the same party. But the ability for a Trump to emerge is so telling. And I think it ultimately is all about race. I think race is the original sin of the Republican Party. And I think when you go from the 40 or so percent that Eisenhower got in 56 to the 7% that Goldwater got in 64, and the fact that African Americans never came back to the party in any numbers, and the party became a white party for the most part. I think that that set the grounds for an ability for it to become a white grievance party. And that's what the Republican Party is now. It is a white grievance party. I mean, if you turn on Tucker Carlson, who I think represents pretty much the heart and soul of the Republican Party as it is today, his argument basically is, we have to make America safe for white people again. So I don't know what to do with that, except, you know, it's incredibly disturbing, because when a major party embraces this racial grievance as its core, history tells us it's very difficult to unwind.
It is, and I don't think that's an exaggeration. I mean, I think one of the most extraordinary developments that we've seen in this year, even after January 6th, is watching people like Tucker Carlson normalize these ideas of white grievance, and the fact that he actually talks about the Great Replacement Theory. I mean, 5 minutes ago, the Great Replacement Theory was something that you would only find among neo-Nazis and white nationalists, who we could sort of regard as often the fringes, and now he's made it right front and center, and you see it repeated over and over again. I mean, you watch how these ideas kind of spread. You know, he begins to say, well, they are bringing in these, you know, these immigrants to replace, or they are bringing in these refugees. And before you know it, you have congressmen from Wisconsin who would never have said that out loud before, saying the exact sort of same thing. So I guess what shocks me is the way in which they've moved past dog whistles. It's so explicit now. And yet, and this is the question I want to ask you, why is there no pushback from the Republicans who know better? And you know that there are Republicans who know better. You know that there are people who've been around for generations who know that for years, Republicans and conservatives pushed back against these notions that they were racist. And now it's right front and center. So, you know, why are they so silent?
I think that one of the lessons is that we should not be surprised by cowardice. We should be surprised by courage. And I think it's cowardice. I think it's an ability to put what is right above what is comfortable. And that really shouldn't be shocking. It should be extraordinary when someone stands up like Liz Cheney did.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, with Donald Trump, it's not that Donald Trump made people more racist, but he made it acceptable to be racist. I think had Donald Trump been a bank robber, probably bank robbing would have become more socially acceptable. And it's the party has embraced this. And it's just a reality now.
It is.
And I don't think it's going to change anytime soon. You know, I really see the business that we're in. I mean, I work with the Lincoln Project now. I think we're in the business of trying to hold the line to pass it on to another generation. That's it. That's what we're trying to do. Because of Americans who are 15 years and under, the majority are not white. 1 out of 10 of the new Americans in the most recent census is white. That is the death of the Republican Party as a white grievance party. So all we have to do, I mean, those kids who are 15 and under, who are non-white now, the odds are really, really good they're going to be non-white when they're 18. And what we have to do is hold the line here so there still is a country that we can recognize that we can pass on to them. And that will force the Republican Party to change, because ultimately their path is going to be the path of what happened in California, where the party bounces back and forth between an irrelevant third and an irrelevant second. And parties and will ultimately, I think, do what they need to do to survive. So I think it is only fear that will cause them, fear and defeat. It's not going to be shame. It's not going to be any higher principles. And that's, we just have to hold the line here. It's why, you know, I wish I wasn't doing what I was doing. I don't think I'd ever make another ad again. I mean, but I don't think I can walk away. I mean, I feel responsible in helping create this. I don't, you know, there's people that write books like if only they had listened to me. That's kind of a Washington trope. I can't write that book because they didn't listen to me. I mean, yeah. If I was
if drawn, only you had ignored me.
I mean, yeah. if I was drawn to the party in part because the value that I placed on personal responsibility, which turned out to be a total fraud, because now we're the anti-personal responsibility party. The Republicans are. I don't really consider myself Republican now. I don't know how to begin to come to grips with that without accepting personal responsibility. And I was there. I mean, I helped elect more of these people than anybody. And I can't, you know, I look back and say, what should I have done differently? Yeah. Probably a lot of things. But I don't know what to do about that now except go forward. I think that the greatest danger is not recognizing the greatest danger. And if you look at this, those who support democracies have a tendency to have the inability to imagine democracies fading into something that doesn't really resemble a democracy. And that lack of imagination, I think, is one of the greatest advantages that autocratic forces in America today have. Because they believe they're going to win. And there are buffoonish characters out there, the Marjorie Taylor Greens, the Matt Gaetz. But they are advantaged to these people because it makes people look at this movement as buffoonish and stupid. And they're not. They're well-funded, they're very patient, and they believe they're going to win. And I can't say the outcome is certain. I don't. I mean, the Republican Party will not accept that we live in a democracy today. That is the official position of the Republican Party, that Joe Biden was not a legally elected president.
Well, let me go to your point, though, because I do think that the lack of imagination is the key thing. And I think that there was for a long time, and maybe still is, complacency being the default setting a lot of the chattering classes, which is, okay, the norms held, the institutions held. Well, it's not going to be that bad. We just had a long piece in the Bulwark about, you know, Ross Douthat of the New York Times, who constantly is arguing that, these people are not competent enough to stage a coup. We shouldn't be that concerned about it. And then suddenly there is that sense of, okay, wait, why do we think that America is immune to history? That why do we think that the forces that destroy democracies and liberal constitutional republics wouldn't affect us? And I do think that that's going to be one of the big, questions, whether or not that recognition of the threat grows as quickly as the reality of the threat is growing. And I think that's the point you just made.
Yeah.
Right? I mean it's like, if we don't recognize the reality of the threat, we are not going to be ready for it. And then we're going to be sitting there on January 6th, 2025, and watch as Congress overturns the Electoral College or something like that. Or
absolutely.
The popular vote, I mean.
Look, if you compare us to Germany, and I'm a contrarian on this, they say that, you can't, anytime you start talking about World War II, you're out. You've gone into hyperbole. And I think we have to look at Germany because I think it is the best and closest example, that and modern-day Hungary. But if you look at where Germany was in 1923, 1924, the forces that turned Germany into what Germany became were much less successful initially than the forces that are an autocratic movement in America are today. So they're ahead of schedule. So we have to think that, you know, they look at January 6th as a failure and they're not going to do this again because it's not punished. They say, look, that's not the right way. We're not going to take this over by force. We have to take it over at the ballot box. So, look, if I had, you know, woken you up, you'd woken me up, you know, a few years ago and said, look, in Texas, they're going to be offering a bounty to turn in your neighbor, a taxpayer-paid bounty, I would have laughed. And that's what it is. And if we don't think the Texas is going to become a model, of course it is.
Okay, but you're a political guy. You're a messaging guy. And I've been involved in abortion politics for almost my entire adult life. This strikes me as like it was cooked up in a laboratory of bad ideas in terms of marketing a political movement, making a cultural point. I guess, you know, I know that Republicans in Texas are patting themselves on the back for being so clever and in evading scrutiny by the Supreme Court. But from a political point of view, Stuart, this just strikes me as the most toxic thing they could do.
Let's hope so.
Well, first of all, do you agree? So, I mean, how do you think it will play in 2022?
I mean, in a world in which Donald Trump was president, anything's possible. I mean, if I said to you, a failed casino owner who talks in public about having sex with his daughter is going to be the Republican nominee, we would have laughed. So I think that jury is still out, very much out, in a literal sense, because it's going to be voted on. So obviously, Abbott looked at this. He could have vetoed this. He could have pocket vetoed it. He's up for reelection. He decided it was in his best interest to sign it. So I know the Abbott political people. They're not dumb. They think they're going to win this. And I used to know Greg Abbott a little bit around Austin in 99 and 2000. He was charming, reasonable, you know, funny. I couldn't imagine that that person would be someone who would sign a bounty that enables somebody living down the street from the governor's mansion in Austin to turn in his daughter. But he has. So we got to get out of that.
So what does he think he's going to, but what does he think that he's going to win? Because I've never seen a public opinion poll that would, well, so with a general election, a general electorate, not just a Republican primary. The Republicans are clearly motivated to turn out and vote. It's a midterm election. We kind of know what that's like. It kind of has a 2010 vibe to me. But if there's any issue that would motivate Democrats, including women, to turn out, it has to be this one.
I hope so.
This strikes me as the worst possible issue from the Republican point of view.
Look, I want to believe this is overreach. I want to believe that it is a tremendous advantage for Democrats. I want to believe that it's going to result in Abbott's defeat and having a Democratic governor. And once Texas goes Democrat in a presidential race, the essential purpose of the Republican Party is going to be to repeal the Electoral College. Because once Texas goes Democrat, we'll never win another election. I mean, the math
it's going to be
is
interesting.
Not there.
Yeah.
So you're going to watch
They switch sides on that, yeah.
You know, I'd like to think that's going to happen, but I mean, is it certain? No. I'm greatly inspired, moved, encouraged by when I see younger voters in Texas mobilizing against this. I think it's an opportunity to show the path that the party would like to take the country, because this is what they want to do. But talk to me, you know, talk to me in December 2020. I don't know. 2022. I don't know.
I sense that you, like a lot of us, are still suffering from a little bit of PTSD from the last 4 years. because if Donald Trump gets elected president, anything's possible, right?
Anything's possible. And, you know, those of us in politics, you know, all these people around Trump, right? The Lewandowskis, the Kellyanne Conways, the Bannons, yeah, all of these people, it's not like they woke up in 2016 and decided they wanted to be involved in presidential politics. They all wanted to be involved in presidential campaigns we worked in. But nobody would let these freaks in. And that's, you know, it's not just Donald Trump. We got to remember that. It's the people that he surrounded himself with, you know, who, I mean, look, we've got a guy, you know, his campaign manager, his deputy campaign manager, his national security advisor, his foreign policy advisor, and his chief political advisor are all convicted of felonies. And yet, you know, we're the law and order party. So it is empowering a group of people who are really bad people, the Jason Millers of the world. So, who was my intern, for God's sake.
Oh, really?
I will forever apologize to the world. You know, it's probably going to be my obituary. You know, Jason Miller was his intern.
People who work with me then,
whenever they like to torture me, they say, you know, Stuart, you like Jason. Which I can't really remember if I did, but it makes me fear.
Say I got Ron Johnson on my dance card, so.
But, I mean, so.
So it is kind of the confederacy of the worst people in the world.
Yes, which that's exactly what happened in Germany. It's what's happening in Hungary. Yeah. And it gives them tremendous power. And will they come into power again? I don't know.
It's possible. So let's go back to your point. You think that the Democrats ought to run on democracy. And I don't disagree, but define democracy to me. Because I think for a lot of people, it means whatever they want it to be, and it's sometimes vague. Mm-hmm. So what is democracy, and why do you say that Republicans are against democracy and are autocratic? Because, of course, they would turn it around and say it's the Democrats that are believe in big government and mandates and rules and everything. You know, we're still the party of freedom. So what is the essence of democracy?
The fundamental definition is, in a democracy, somebody has to be willing to lose. Mm-hmm. And the Republican Party's official position is now they are for democracy when they win, and when they're not, it was an illegitimate election. That's their fundamental. That is their position. It's not something they whisper. It's something they say aloud. So, I mean, those of us who work in politics know that, you know, voter fraud is somewhere up there like elephantitis in America. I mean, it's there, but it's, you know, there's a reason there's a National Cancer Center, not a National Elephantitis Center. It's not a huge problem. And to be able to have a party question the legitimacy of an overwhelming victory by Joe Biden and to still be about the business of refusing to admit that we live in a democracy, that's the fundamental definition. Are you willing to lose? And Republicans have taken the official position they're not willing to lose. They will not admit defeat. They will admit failure, but they will not admit defeat. And that's anti-democratic. So it America at its greatest, best moments is when we fought for democracy. And that is the legacy of the greatest generation. I mean, people like my dad who, you know, fought 3 years in the South Pacific, 28 island landings, and came back and like so many never talked about it and just went about his life. Those are the people that handed this generation of politicians the greatest legacy in history. And Republicans have squandered that. And you have to bring it up to that level. You have to bring it up to what is it that defines being an American? And what defines being an American is an ability to embrace the fact that you may not be correct, that others have a voice, that we have a pluralistic society, that we will compromise. And that is antithetical to what it is to be a Republican now. So you have to put it up on that level. You have to challenge them. You have to say that they are trying to undo what the greatest generation fought and gave us for. And fight it out on that. And I think that's a winnable race. But you've got to set the terms of that race. You've got to be in that race to win that race. And every election is about, what is this race about? So, you know, and a lot of people going into, a lot of Democrats going into 2020 said that this race should not be about Donald Trump. And that made a lot of sense in a lot of ways. Whatever you thought about Donald Trump was baked into the cake. You couldn't say anything about Donald Trump that was going to change anybody's opinion. You had to make it about issues. That was the Elizabeth Warren position. Perfectly defensible, not insane. I just think it was wrong. And I think one of the great gifts that the Lincoln Project brought to this is saying firmly, this is about Donald Trump. Donald Trump is the first 10 issues in this race. And the Lincoln Project said it before Joe Biden was a nominee. And that is close to what Joe Biden's message was, that this is a referendum on the soul of America. And that is what we have to go back to win this election. Because Trump is on the, Trumpism is on the ballot now. Trump isn't, but Trumpism is. And that's what you got to fight that race. Now, maybe you lose that race, but it's the best shot you have.
So I don't disagree with that, but I wonder whether or not running on democracy is an abstract issue as opposed to the tangible issues that generally move voters. And you're obviously much more informed about this, but the Republicans are going to run on, they're going to run on crime, on Afghanistan, on the border, on the dangers of inflation, all of those things. Those are powerful issues going into a midterm election. And especially if there's a perception, you correct me if you maybe you can push back on this, if there's a perception that Democrats are overplaying their majority, voters often will come in and say, I want to check what I regard of the as the excesses of the incumbent party. Those dynamics seem very, very powerful to me.
Yeah, I mean, the other side gets a voice. I think that the best thing politically that the Biden administration can do is govern well. I mean, there are times when good politics is good policy, and good policy is good politics. And I think that if they can pass this bill, I mean, I know, I can't tell you how many races I went out and fought to try to get people to vote against spending, and it never worked. People love spending. That's
really
why they do it.
Okay.
I mean, yeah. So I think that if you look at the economy, look at how the economy is growing. So if you go into this election with an economy that is banging around 4 or 5%, and you've passed a series of legislations, a bill that provides true infrastructure that is going to help people in these states, and you turn it into a referendum on you're going to take that that away, that money that you got to build roads in Mississippi, that's going to be taken away. I think that that's the role that the Biden administration needs to play. The Biden administration can't go out and demonize Republicans. That's not what they can't go out and say Republicans aren't for democracy, because they have to govern, and they are still a governing party. The Republican Party has really become not a governing party now. It's become a party that opposes Democrats. That's not what governing is about. And I think it's up to those of us who are outside of that direct administration to frame the race what it is about. And we can say things.
So you're saying, okay. So when you said before that you have to make Donald Trump the issue, you're talking about the third parties need to do this, that the Democrats themselves are not able to make Donald Trump?
I think the DNC, I think the DNC can do it. I think, look, I mean, I think this is one of the great advantages the Lincoln Project has, is because we don't have any clients. We don't have any group that's special interest that supports us. So we have complete freedom to go out and say the Republican Party is an autocratic movement. We know. We were part of it. Believe us. And that is something that we don't have to worry about the impact that's going to have on a vote. We don't have to worry about whether or not we don't poll any of these things. We don't focus group. We just go out and say these things. It's sort of conviction politics. So I think the Democrats need to go out and say that. They need to say this forcefully. For the life of me, Charlie, I do not understand this kind of inferiority complex that Democrats seem to have about their electoral ability. I mean, they've won the popular vote every time since 1988. I mean, I was in these races. I was in the race where we won the popular vote in 2004. It was hard. Hard. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if I could say anything to Democrats, I would say, man, walk with a little swagger. There's more of you than the other guys. And you're right and they're wrong. And start acting like that. It's your country, too. Don't be out there saying the Republicans are better at this. Just get about the business of doing what you can do better than they can. And you know, do it with confidence. And not this timidity and not this, well, we're gonna lose. Republicans are better at this. Republicans aren't better at this. Republicans are the one that just passed a bounty in Texas and think it's good electoral politics. Prove them wrong. Ram it down their throats. Make them eat that every day. You know, does John Cornyn support that? Does Ted Cruz support that? So that's how you gotta do this thing. And
who impresses you the most among Democratic politicians? You know, one of the things I'm looking at is I don't know what Joe Biden's future is, whether he's going to be a one-term president, whether he's going to run for office. So who comes next? I mean, when he was running, he said, I'm a transitional figure. Transitional figure to who? If you could advise the Democratic Party and say, these are the kinds of stars that will drive your success in the future, who, any names come to mind?
Well, look, I think the future of the Democratic Party is a future that is a very diverse party. And you know, people say, how come there aren't three parties in America? I really think there are three parties in America. There's two inside the Democratic Party. There's sort of, say, a Biden party, and there's, say, an AOC party, a Sanders party. America will accept fascism before we accept socialism. And you have to have a unifying figure who can bring these elements together. Now, Donald Trump was in many ways a unifying figure for the Democratic Party. But you have to have someone who has that ability to bring all the party together. Now, probably that person needs to be a person of color. Probably, it would be a great advantage if that person was a woman. I actually have a lot more respect for Kamala Harris's potential as a politician than a lot of people. I think she's very compelling. I would not write her off in the least. But it has to be someone who can speak to both sides of the party. And there's a strength to that diversity in the party. But there's also obviously tremendous risk of fractionalization, of purity test. So you can't... If you really believe democracy is at stake, what does that say that you have to do? And that says that you have to work with people that you don't agree with on everything for a greater good. And if the Democratic Party doesn't accept that as a truth, it means that they really don't believe that democracy is at stake. Because you don't act like that when democracy is at stake. That's not how we fought World War II.
We'll get a test of this, won't we, on this $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill?
Yes. And I'm optimistic about this, actually. You know, I have a lot of respect for the Biden world. I think they ran a brilliant campaign. And, you know, to defeat an incumbent president, particularly when there's not spending limits. I mean, the last time an incumbent president that we didn't have spending limits that did level the playing field, the last time an incumbent president without spending limits lost was Herbert Hoover. And he had a bad year. And the Biden people went out and they did something really, really hard and rare in American politics. And they did incredible things along the way, like reinvent what a convention is. And I just, as pure politics, as the craft of it, it's like, man, that is good. You look at the weakest period of any challenger to an incumbent president is right after you win the nomination, because you have to go out and get people that you were, you know, beating their brains out for the last few months to work with you. You're broke. And every time in modern politics, an incumbent president has faced a challenger, in the 2 months after the challenger won the nomination, the incumbent went up. And that didn't happen. Biden went up this time. Now, you could say it's because of COVID, but then, you know, you look at Cuomo. Cuomo went up because of COVID. It didn't have to be that way. So, you know, they had a good May and a good June 2020. And I just step back and I just look at that with awe. I mean, I've been in
those rooms. They had a terrible August. Yeah, but they've had an awful August 2021. How optimistic are you that he can pull out of this particular problem? I mean, he's cratered in terms of his approval ratings.
I was a Bush guy in 91 when we thought we were invulnerable because Bush had 89% favorable. So
things change.
That didn't seem to mean a lot, you know, a year later. You know, I was a Reagan guy when, you know, 241 Marines and an ill-defended position on an ill-defined mission were killed. And, you know, I remember Reagan winning 49 states, you know, about a year later, year and a half later. So, you know, I think one of the greatest undervalued qualities in politics is patience and understanding that you can't win every news cycle. You can't win every week. And ultimately, you know, you have to win. We used to say you only have to win one day. Now you only have to win, you know, a few weeks. So I think that what I like about the Biden people is their steadiness. These are people who do not panic. And that is a quality that in politics will tend to serve you well. I think actually Delta variant is a greater threat to the Biden presidency than Afghanistan. Because if the Delta variant ends up really, you know, limiting the ability for the economy to grow and throws our schools in turmoil, and we go, you know, there's exhaustion out there, obviously, about so many things, but COVID is one. I think that is the greatest threat to Biden's reelection. So I think that's a great unknown, obviously. But I don't think that Republicans have a very good message. I don't know really what it is. And they don't either. And they're out there just throwing stuff up against the wall to see what sticks. So, you know, they negotiated this deal with the Taliban and they're acting like this was, you know, some sort of great sin against America. I'd a lot rather be the person that ended a war that, you know, Americans didn't tend to care about Afghanistan when Americans were getting killed. I don't think they're going to care a lot about Afghanistan when Americans aren't getting killed a year from now.
See, this is the key point, though, is how many times have we experienced this where some major event happens and then 3 months later we look back at this and go, hey, do you remember when everybody thought that was going to make a difference or that? Because things do move quickly. Stuart, Stephen, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. The book is It Was All a Lie, How the Republican Party Became Donald Trump. I think it's one of the most important volumes of the Trump era, especially from Republicans, former Republicans who are wrestling with the question of how did this happen? What just happened? You know, what did we miss? What did we get completely wrong? And this book is out, and it was the New York Times bestseller in hardcover and came out in paperback yesterday, and you can order it. So, Stuart Stevens, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast.
Thanks, Charles. Great to be here, man, and I love what you guys are doing.
Thank you. And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.